ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The private army of more than 50,000 and a key force in Russia's battle against Ukraine, the Wagner Group, has been accused of human rights abuses and atrocities.
The head of the Wagner mercenary group, Yevgeny Prigozhin, says that his forces are now in control of the headquarters of Russia's southern military district.
Yevgeny Prigozhin and his men left for cheers from crowds who'd gathered to watch their late-night departure.
Wagner mercenaries have left the Russian city of Rostov-on-Don after its founder agreed to put an end to his uprising against the Kremlin.
In June this year, 2023, the Wagner Group, a Russian private military company and a key force in Russia's invasion of Ukraine, stopped fighting and began marching on Moscow. It was a move that surprised everyone, including Russian President Vladimir Putin. It also raised serious questions about the role private military companies, or mercenaries, play in modern-day conflicts. While it's the Wagner Group making headlines today, it's not the only private military company around, and Russia's not the only nation employing them. The US military, for example, used private military companies extensively in Iraq and Afghanistan. Hello, I'm Annabelle Quince. In this Rear Vision, private military companies, or should we really call them mercenaries? Through most of the 20th century, mercenaries didn't exist. Or if they did, they existed on the fringes of society. Major conflicts like World War I, World War II, or the Korean War were waged by national armies. But as we'll learn, this was a unique period. Historically, mercenaries have always played a major role in conflicts. So exactly what is a mercenary, and when and where have they been used?
Mercenary has always been the same. It's an armed civilian who fights in foreign wars chiefly for profit and uses force in a paramilitary way. Dr. Sean McFate, and I am a professor of war. I'm a former private military contractor, U.S. Army paratrooper, and I've written several books now, fiction and nonfiction, on the world of mercenaries today. Mercenaries are the second oldest profession. So they're mentioned several times in the Old Testament and never with scorn. In classical antiquity, it's how wars were fought. Roman Empire depended largely on mercenary armies. In the Middle Ages in Europe, mercenaries were how wars were conducted. Even popes used to hire mercenary armies. Mercenaries were the common way of war all the way until around 1648.
As long as we've had warfare, pretty much we've had mercenaries in warfare. We've had people who are doing the fight for money. They're often highly professionalized. They often have specific technical skills that regular soldiers don't have. I'm Sarah Percy, and I'm an associate professor in international relations at the University of Queensland.
And you have actually written a book about the history of mercenaries, haven't you?
I have. The book is called Mercenaries, the History of a Norm in International Relations. The main reason why people have mercenaries isn't because they want them, it's because they have to have them. And there are two reasons for it. One reason is that the state itself struggles with its administrative ability. So it's actually very technically complicated to have an army that can sustain itself. And that requires quite a robust state with quite robust administrative structures and practices, but requires a lot of bureaucracy. Whereas having mercenaries, it doesn't do that. You just hire the mercenaries to do it for you. And the other scenario historically where people relied on mercenaries is because they had some sort of technical capacity. So, for example, in the 16th century, a lot of mercenary companies, particularly from Switzerland, were experts in pike warfare, which is one of the cutting edge technologies of the day. And rather than trying to train your own people who might owe you a feudal service obligation, so they wouldn't necessarily be the best soldiers, you would hire this sort of specialist troop with specific technical skills to come and support your military.
So historically, who actually employed mercenaries?
Yeah, so when we look at this from our 21st century vantage point, we see mercenaries or the idea that people who have armies are states, because that's our context. But obviously, historically, and particularly in the post-classical period, so from, let's say, from what we would call the Middle Ages onwards, lots and lots of people wielded force in the international system, in the political system, because no one actor had a monopoly over the use of violence. So everyone needed to have some degree of force to protect themselves because, by and large, the state wasn't capable of providing that for people. So the range of people who were in authority and had enough authority to have an army was much bigger than it is later on. So that would include lords, popes, you know, all sorts of different people who have authority, but also just very wealthy people who might not be titled in any way. I mean, often very wealthy people were titled, but anybody who needed to protect something, a trade route, a big house, they might be hiring professional soldiers. Whether or not we would call those people mercenaries rather than, say, bodyguards, I think that's actually a bit of a blurry distinction. We would expect to see mercenaries more often in expeditionary warfare or actually engaging in the practice of warfare rather than just guarding somebody's house.
And how were these mercenaries typically paid for?
The question of how they get paid is really interesting. Mercenary contracts become very common, particularly in the Italian city-states in the 15th and 16th centuries, and they're quite elaborate. They specify everything that the mercenary is going to get paid and how they're going to be paid. Sometimes that contract would include the prospect of pillage and booty if the mercenaries were successful, and sometimes it would just include sort of cash payments as you might expect. But there's definitely, being a mercenary captain, you could be quite lucrative if you were good at it. Like any profession of arms, you didn't necessarily have the longest life expectancy. It's a pretty dangerous profession, but you could make a lot of money doing it if you were good at it.
There were, however, disadvantages in using mercenaries, which became very evident during the Hundred Years' War between France and England, which ran from 1337 to 1453.
There are big disadvantages to using mercenaries, and we talked briefly about the question of payment. Mercenaries never thought they were paid enough. And of course, if you have an armed group of men who are highly experienced fighters, you can supplement your wages pretty easily by basically looting and pillaging your way around the countryside if you feel you're not getting paid enough, if your payment is light. So mercenaries are actually very dangerous actors. So in the Hundred Years' War, you get a huge problem where there are some pauses in hostilities during the Hundred Years' War, and the pause in the hostilities is bad for the mercenaries because they're not getting paid. And what they do is they race around the countryside looting and pillaging. And there's actually some papal bulls that are issued against mercenaries saying these guys are bad guys, we need to get rid of them. So there's always this sense that mercenaries are a necessary evil, but they can go very badly wrong for rulers. In the Italian city-state, so again, prior to the 30 Years' War, most of the Italian city-states rely heavily on mercenary captains for, they call them condottieri, which comes from the Italian for contract, condotta. They are how you both protect your city and fight against other city-states. But the mercenaries would do things like extort the city that hired them if they didn't feel like they were getting paid enough. And there's been this very detailed history done of the mercenaries in Siena, the condottieri, who were basically responsible for the bankruptcy of Siena and its decline in power relative to other city-states.
The idea that mercenaries were a necessary evil began to change after the 30-Year War, 1618 to 1648, one of the longest and most destructive conflicts in European history, due in no small part to the behaviour of mercenaries.
We forget now that the 30 Years' War killed more Central Europeans percentage-wise than World War II. And mercenary proliferation, there was like a mercenary arms race in the 30 Years' War. And one of the greatest mercenary providers was this guy called Wallenstein. And he worked for Emperor Ferdinand II, who was on the Catholic side of the war. And he would churn out huge rental regiments. And he's kind of like what Prigozhin is today. He's not himself a fighter. He was more of a businessman in a very lucrative business. He got so powerful and so rich that the emperor had him secretly assassinated in his bedroom at night.
The type of mercenary system which begins to persist during the 30 Years' War is a bit different because we get something in the German context called a military enterpriser. And Wallenstein is the most famous one of these. And what they do is they don't just provide you with soldiers, they provide you with everything the army needs. So they do all of the logistics as well. So they provide uniforms, They provide food. They bring everything. They solve all of those administrative and logistical burdens, which are very big for states and that states aren't actually capable of doing themselves.
The classic problem of mercenary warfare is control and safety, because there's no real way to control mercenaries. And there's no court of law you can sue mercenaries in, or vice versa, because it's also clients who would rip off the mercenaries. So what would happen is that mercenaries and masters would rip each other off all the time, and the bill payers of that were the common people. And that's what happened in the 30 Years' War. Contractors, mercenaries, when they were just sitting in a garrison guarding a castle, they would start to prey on the people and, you know, rape, extortion, murder, having whatever they wanted. And who's going to, you know, is the king going to send in troops from the 30 Years' War to calm down his own mercenaries? He couldn't afford it. So what we saw was a lot of bad behavior. And then mercenaries, they don't like to work themselves out of a job. So in between contracts, historically, mercenaries become bandits. They become extortionists, racketeers. If we think about mercenary warfare like supply and demand, they're the one supply that can generate their own demand. And we saw that in extreme in this 30 Years' War.
At the end of the 30-year war, trade in and control over mercenaries shifted from individual businessmen to states.
You see this transition from the individual captain who is capable of commanding a large force to a state-to-state based trade. So the idea that you can hire soldiers doesn't go away, but states pretty quickly work out that it's a bad idea to have individually significantly empowered military captains that can command their own troops. Is not a great idea when you're trying to run a state because it's a direct competitor. But a lot of the same problems still exist where states still need to supplement their own military forces. So the solution is for the state to bring the mercenary trade under its own control and then sell regiments like any other commodity. So as opposed to selling cotton or woven goods, you would say, well, I can sell you a regiment. It'll come serve for this period of time. It's willing to serve in these locations, but not in these locations. So you get this very regularized form of military contracting. And that persists from the 17th century, as I said, right through until the Crimean War, so the middle of the 19th century.
The Crimean War occurred at the very moment nation states began to establish their own standing armies, armies based on the idea of conscription.
So the 19th century is a really huge moment for a lot of different aspects of military history. And what begins to happen is you see a very strong move towards conscription. And the deal with conscription is we will let you be a soldier for us, or we'll make you be a soldier for us, in fact. And in exchange, we'll give you political rights. So that bargain is inherent to citizenship in most Western democracies, that as conscription gets more and more developed, citizenship rights are gradually extended to people at the same time. So they go hand in glove. But it becomes very difficult to say, I've made you come fight for me, ideally out of patriotism, out of a notion of service to the state. But right next to you, there's going to be some guy who I've hired, and he's only in it for the money. And that becomes increasingly morally problematic. So the British actually recruit quite a lot of mercenaries to go fight in Crimea, but the war ends before they can get there. The debate around their recruitment in Parliament is very intense. People are convinced that it is utterly immoral in the context of citizen service to rely on mercenaries to do your fighting for you. And that debate in the British context, and at this stage, they're the main consumers of mercenaries. So when they stop using mercenaries, the trade kind of subsides.
By the beginning of the 20th century, mercenaries had disappeared, being replaced by national armies, made up of conscripts and volunteers.
Mercenaries disappear from the Crimean War in the 19th century until the Cold War. If they existed anywhere, they were in the very peripheries of international relations. And then they started to make their way quietly back in the Cold War as the USSR and the United States and others use them in places like Africa as proxies. And we started to see them in wars of decolonization. But they were a trickle and they were always in the shadows.
With the end of the Cold War, mercenaries started to emerge from the shadows. Companies like Executive Outcomes, which was founded in South Africa in 1989.
We see the first manifestation of this in Africa and to an extent in Papua New Guinea, where two companies called Executive Outcomes and Sandline are created with the idea that they will sell you any type of military service you need, including actively going out and fighting and prosecuting your war.
Many of the mercenaries in Africa in the 1990s were former South African special forces, both black and white, and they were left to rot. So when the apartheid regime collapsed, they were left in the field fighting wars in Rhodesia, and they decided to go into business for themselves. And they were hired to, for example, you know, destroy rebel groups in Sierra Leone and other places. And they were paid by governments, even though the United Nations said, don't hire them. And this came to a head during the Rwanda genocide. Many of your listeners will recall that the Rwanda genocide in 1993, 800,000 to 900,000 people were killed in 90 days, which is more than all Iraqis and Afghanis combined over 20 years. And Executive Outcomes talked to the United Nations and said, look, for $120 million, which is nothing for the UN, we will stop this genocide until you can generate a substantial peacekeeping force. And infamously, the UN said, no, the world's not ready to privatize peacekeeping. And as a result, hundreds of thousands were massacred. And that shows you some of the ideological conundrums of mercenaries, because if used properly, they can also be a force for good. Mercenaries can be like fire. They can either power a steam engine or burn down your house.
In 1995, it was the private military company, Executive Outcomes, who was called in to help the Sierra Leone government end a civil war.
But what they do is they provide assistance to countries who are not getting assistance from the international community. I spoke about the company Executive Outcomes, and they came to the assistance of the Sierra Leonean government in the late 90s. And the reason why they were there is because no one else would go. And I interviewed some Sierra Leonean officials when I was first doing research on this topic. And they said to me, what else were we supposed to do? The UN wasn't coming to help us. They were indeed facing a terrible rebel group, the Rebel United Front, whose favorite tactic was removing people's right arms, amputating them so they wouldn't be able to work. These rebels were getting closer and closer to Freetown, which was the capital of Sierra Leone, and there was no help forthcoming from the international community, none whatsoever. So that was the choice. We hire this company that nobody wants us to hire, or we just let ourselves get overrun by rebels. And what do we do? And the difficulties that the UN has in providing robust peacekeeping assistance has not assisted that.
While in the 1990s, the UN and most Western nations opposed the use of mercenaries by nations like Sierra Leone, that changed with the terrorist attacks of 9/11 and the subsequent conflicts in Iraq and in Afghanistan.
And there's all of this general public disapproval, and then the war in Iraq happens. And the war in Iraq creates this demand on the part of the United States in particular, that they need more troops than they have. They've been downsizing their military for years up until 9/11 and then the invasion of Iraq. So they're reliant on private security companies. So a lot of these guys kind of reinvent themselves. They say, we're not actually going to do the selling of active military services where we'll go fight your war for you. We're not going to do that anymore. But we will provide, quote unquote, security services for you. So we'll call ourselves a private security company and not a private military company. And we will help you do military adjacent tasks up to and including defensive tasks, but we will not engage in force offensively. We will not go out and fight your war for you. And so that becomes really, really significant in the war in Iraq in 2003 and to a lesser extent in Afghanistan.
So the mercenary industry has had three major leaps. One was after the Cold War ended, where we started to see them reemerge quietly in Africa. The next were the 9/11 wars, U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, where United States thought erroneously those would be quick and easy wars, and they realized that their all-volunteer military didn't have enough volunteers to maintain this longer fight. So they were left with three bad options. One is to leave Afghanistan and Iraq and cede defeat to al-Qaeda. The second would be to have a Vietnam-like draft, which would have been political suicide. And the third would be to hire contractors. Initially, just a little bit, like Blackwater and Triple Canopy and DynCorp.
Blackwater was founded in the 1990s by fundamentalist Christian and former Navy SEAL Eric Prince. In a promotional video released during the Iraq War, he explained how the Bush administration benefited from companies such as Blackwater.
The deaths of Blackwater contractors and other war contractors are not included in the total death count. Their crimes don't get punished. Blackwater and other companies benefit the Bush administration, and in turn, the Bush administration and its Republican allies in Congress have shielded these military contractors from any effective oversight.
And of course, as these wars extended, they became more and more reliant on contractors to carry forward these wars. So there were, for every soldier on the ground, there would be one or two contractors. And most of those contractors were not pulling triggers. Only about 10 to 15% were pulling triggers, but that 10 to 15% was enough to launch a worldwide market for force, so a global industry of mercenaries.
Now to the war in Ukraine, where Moscow has reportedly deployed up to thousands of mercenaries in an effort to win control of parts of eastern Ukraine.
Wagner chief Yevgeny Prigozhin is claiming victory for Russia in Soledar. In a statement, the head of Russia's private military firm said his forces had captured all of the town and killed hundreds of Ukrainian soldiers.
Wagner first formed in 2014 in Ukraine. Following Russia's 2014 invasion of Ukraine, you have the quote-unquote little green men who are carrying out Russian operations, and many of those were actually the earliest age of Wagner.
My name is Katrina Doxy, and I am the Associate Director and an Associate Fellow with the Transnational Threats Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. They form Wagner in response to Russia's need for military operations in Ukraine that can be deniable and can happen below the threshold of full-on state-to-state warfare. And coming out of Ukraine, where that deniability had mixed success, we still clearly identified that Russia was the state behind these so-called little green men. But this kind of became an appealing model for Moscow. And you had people like Prigozhin high up in the group who were really pitching this as a new way that Russia could think about advancing its geopolitical interests. So on the heels of their use in Ukraine, Russia also used Wagner in Syria. Again, this force multiplier. That was kind of the first time that this Wagner name really started to spread, at least in military and security circles. We then saw that Wagner deployed to Libya, and then we started to see around 2017 and 2018 an evolution in the model, where instead of just using Wagner as this force multiplier, either for Russian military operations or in support of a Russian ally, we started to have Wagner used, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, as this quasi-third party who could come in and reach an agreement with a local host state to provide a range of paramilitary intelligence and information services. And in exchange for those services, Wagner would be able to secure access to natural resources and other economic gains, as well as various geopolitical and military goals of the Russian state. Now, the countries that they targeted in Africa were largely ones with ongoing security challenges, often in the form of terrorist or insurgent activity, as well as countries that had weak governance and those rich natural resources that they could exploit. Those were things like gold, rare earth minerals and gemstones, energy resources such as oil or liquid natural gas. But we also see over time that they expanded into industries like timber and coffee as well.
They call themselves a private security company, but really what they are from the moment of their emergence, and everybody knows it, is a covert arm of the Russian state. So it's a military that allows the Russian state to intervene in conflicts like Syria, where a full-scale Russian mobilization of the same size would be internationally impossible or very risky. It allows them to sort of hide behind this pretense that they're not really involved. And people are willing to turn a blind eye to this practice because Russia has nuclear weapons and nobody wants to provoke Russia. So they kind of get away with it. But everybody knows it's just a way for Putin to deploy troops that gets around what limited controls there are on his ability to do so, and also allows him to intervene in conflicts which might be internationally impossible otherwise. They're not an independent company. Like, you and I could not hire the Wagner Group, whereas you could hire a company like DynCorp, which was one of the companies in Iraq. The ABC could absolutely hire them. If the ABC tried to hire the Wagner Group, I think all kinds of questions would be asked, but it would also be impossible because they're not for hire for anyone other than Putin and maybe Belarus now, depending on what may or may not have gone down earlier in June.
To Russia now, with a mystery surrounding Wagner mercenary leader Yevgeny Prigozhin just gets murkier. Now, the Kremlin says the very man President Vladimir Putin dubbed a traitor actually met with Prigozhin and nearly three dozen Wagner soldiers just 5 days after they stopped a march on Moscow.
Contractors can become a law unto themselves. And historically, this has happened a lot. They become a Praetorian Guard. They take over whole cities in the Middle Ages and install their own kings like Sforza family in Milan. And, you know, this is what Prigozhin did to Putin when he marched on Moscow to renegotiate a contract, not to take over the Kremlin. And it says something: if sly Putin cannot control mercenaries, then that should be a harbinger for the rest of the world.
I think the Wagner Group is interesting because I think everyone in the world, including probably Putin at the moment, agrees that the Wagner Group is probably a really bad idea and that having a company with that kind of capacity is simply ridiculous. It's not good for anybody, even if you're in an authoritarian state. One of the things that is worth everybody thinking about is there's a reason why we had this slow but quite inexorable evolution in historical terms away from individually empowered captains who could inflict military warfare in any way they wanted to, towards having states do that. And it's a really important feature of how we control modern warfare. Modern warfare is not perfect. Warfare is a horrible thing. But we actually have evolved all kinds of quite good mechanisms that help militaries behave themselves properly, that help militaries conduct themselves in reasonably safe and appropriate ways on the battlefield. And the thing is, when you begin to privatize that, you just lose a lot of that control. What we really do want is we want strong states to maintain control over their forces because it helps keep warfare as safe as it can be, given that it's inherently a very dangerous business.
Sarah Percy, Associate Professor of International Relations at the University of Queensland. My other guests, Katerina Doxey, Associate Director and Associate Fellow with the Transnational Threat Project at the Centre for Strategic and International Studies. And Sean McFate, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Professor of Strategy at the National Defence University in Washington. The sound engineer is Beth Stewart. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.